Ladies and gentlemen, I just wanted to welcome all of you here this evening. I'm Fiona Hill. I'm just about to start on Monday as the new director for the Center for the United States and Europe. So it's a great pleasure to be almost here in person, but having this opportunity to take part in this lecture tonight and to welcome you on behalf of Brookings. Now, many of you in the audience have probably been to in the series of the Raymond Aron lectures. It was launched back in 2004, so we're already in the fifth year, and in fact, the sixth lecture of the series. My predecessor, Phil Gordon, who is now the Assistant Secretary of State for Europe at the Department of State, started the lecture program. And it was started around the time of the centenary of Raymond Aron's birth, and so, of course, the series was named after him, to honour this great scholar, writer, and philosopher, but also to give a platform for inviting distinguished French and American scholars, practitioners, and experts to come together and address important issues to the two countries. This actual lecture is very timely, given the current economic crisis, but what's also remarkable is this is the first lecture we've had in the series on the global economy. Very fitting, of course, for someone like Raymond Aron, who was very much a multifaceted scholar, best known, of course, for most of his work on war and peace, but he was very much engaged in political commentary and also on economic issues. And many of you may know that in his the course of the columns that he wrote for Le Figaro over 30 years, many of them were about the economy or the political economy. And he considered Max Weber, John Maynard Keynes, and Joseph Schumpeter as some of the most important social scientists of the 20th century. Before I introduce the speakers, I'd like to say a very special word of thanks for the support offered for this series by the policy planning staff of the French Foreign Ministry. This lecture series was first started off 6 years ago with the backing of Gilles Andriani of the policy planning staff, and it has also continued with the new directorship of the policy planning staff, Pierre Lévy, and with the great support of the French Embassy, and also with the help of our senior fellow from France, Justin Weiss, here from Brookings, who is sitting in the front row. So I'd just like to say, again, a great word of thanks to our French colleagues for their assistance. Now, it's a sign of the times that the distinguished French economist who is giving our lecture tonight, Jean Pisani-Ferry, who is sitting here at my right, is actually working in Brussels, the centre of European affairs at this moment, and contributing regular papers in both German, French and English. And he is the director of the very famous Brussels-based think tank, the Bruegel Institute, who is one of the main partners of Brookings and other think tanks focusing on the European economics. And Jean contributed to the creation of this institute back in 2005 and also works closely with tonight's discussant, Fred Bergsten, the director of the Peterson Institute for International Economics, our neighbour across Massachusetts Avenue, that wonderfully impressive glass-facaded building that most of you probably walked past on your way here tonight. And we're delighted that Fred is here with us, and I'll just introduce him in a second. But I'd just like to say just a few words about Monsieur Pisani-Ferry, who literally has just flown in from Brussels and is about to fly out again, so we're extraordinarily lucky that he was able to do this. He's had a distinguished career as an academic and economic advisor with numerous positions, including in the French Prime Minister's Council of Economic Analysis, a senior economic advisor to the French Minister of Finance, as the economic advisor for the European Commission, of course also being a professor of economics and a very celebrated researcher on economic policy in Europe. Fred Bergsten, who will offer discussant as soon as Monsieur Pisani-Ferry has finished his presentation, has an equally distinguished career and has actually been named most recently as one of the 10 people who can change your life. Fred hopefully will let us know how we can do this. This is in his commentary on economics. But it's a very exciting thing to be named. I'm not sure who the other 9 are, but anyway, we're very delighted to have Fred here. Fred, as many of you know, has been the Assistant Secretary for International Affairs at the U.S. Treasury. He's also been Under Secretary of Monetary Affairs. and he's had multiple positions in coordinating U.S. foreign economic policy, working with people like Henry Kissinger at the National Security Council. Most relevantly, of course, he's once was a senior fellow here at Brookings, but then he's also been a senior fellow at Carnegie and also at the Council on Foreign Relations. So I guess we're all very lucky to have had a piece of Fred over the last several decades. And Fred is currently, just like Monsieur Pissini-Ferry, working on a whole number of issues related to the global economy, and many of you have probably been to several of the lectures at the Peterson Institute on many of these current themes. So I'm going to turn over now to our distinguished speaker. He will speak for about 30 to or so minutes, 35, 40 minutes. Then Fred will come up immediately afterwards and offer his observations on this for next 10, 15, and then hopefully we'll have a discussion left in the half hour leading up to 7 o'clock, and we'll try to finish promptly in the name of economic efficiency. But we'll have to come down from the podium now, so you'll be able to see the PowerPoint. And just again, thank you so much for all of you for attending this evening.
Thank you very much, Fiona, for your nice words. I'm really pleased to be here. I'm humbled also to be part of this series and of the Raymond Aron lectures. It's probably because there is a good thing in a crisis that you in this series, where mostly people specialized in foreign affairs have featured, that you felt it was time to invite an economist. So I'm grateful to the crisis also for that. Obviously, there is a price to that, that, you know, there are going to be slides and graphs, and no equations, I promise. But, you know, I thought that in the name of credibility, I had to produce something of this sort. I'm also very, very pleased that, that Fred has accepted to be a discussant. I don't know how many people's life has changed, but certainly he's changed my life, because when we created Bruegel, we took inspiration from the Peterson Institute. And so the fact that I live in Brussels and that I work on what I do is a tribute to his achievements at on the other side of the street. I'm going to talk about the transatlantic economy. You may feel that the timing is absolutely right, because the Transatlantic Economic Council meets tomorrow. In fact, it's pure coincidence. We thought with Justin that it would be a good topic to address, and we chose the time, and it happened to be the time where this meeting takes place. This is also an opportunity for me to tell you that I'm not among the specialists of the transatlantic relationship. There are several. There is an industry of this sort. There are some in this room. I'm some kind of a newcomer to it, and I thought that from my perspective of an economist, it would be interesting also to reflect on what the crisis is changing or has changed in the transatlantic relationship. And I'm going to start with some quotes from Fred. Fred is someone who is consistent. He's not volatile. For example, look at what he's said on the U.S. dollar over the years. He's pretty consistent. But here, back in 2003, he said that the U.S. and the EU should form some kind of G2 caucus. Because they are the only superpowers. And 2 years later, he started thinking about the fact that the United States had, in fact, to be part of several G2 with several powers, including the EU, but also China, Japan, and Saudi Arabia, maybe. And finally, this year, very recently, he wrote that, in fact, there is only one G2, the U.S. and China, and that the European Union, not being able to speak with one voice, is simply unable to be part of this G2 that could become a G3. So I think since Fred is consistent, this is not an indication of his volatility, but an indication of how much things are changing around us, how fast the world is transforming and how many repercussions there are for the structure of international governance. The crisis, paradoxically, has in fact both highlighted the importance of this transatlantic economy, the transatlantic link, and led to changes and to some questions about the permanence of this link. If you think about how fast the crisis transmitted from the US to Europe, how simultaneously the economies responded, this is an indication of the intensity of the relationship. I mean, it's a big difference with the crisis in the 30s, where it started in the US and took a long time, in fact, to be transmitted to Europe. Here, it was transmitted instantaneously, and this is a simple testimony of the integration, the degree of integration there is. And also, there was no decoupling. So there was many talks about decoupling, but in fact, there was no decoupling. And the rest of the world was not able to avoid this crisis in the U.S. to transform into a global crisis. So, in a way, it's a recognition that this transatlantic link is fundamental and that there is no alternative engine in the world. At the same time, it has led to the upgrading of the G20 and to the demise of the very transatlantic G7. So the impact in terms of governance is in fact a weakening of the transatlantic link. So it's a paradox we can start from, and which I'm going to discuss. And there are several questions I would like to address in this respect. How the role of the US and Europe have changed as a consequence of the crisis. What is special in this relationship? So is there something special that means it has to be valued and kept and strengthened beyond history? Because obviously history is always important, but history is no justification for keeping things as they are. And I would like to discuss whether there is a kind of transatlantic agenda that comes naturally out of the economic structures and economic nature of economic relationship for the future. So what I'm going to do to discuss that is I'm going to start with some facts, going back to numbers. I'm going then to discuss what I think could be a natural agenda, discuss some of the conditions for effectiveness, especially on the European side, and then conclude. Okay, facts. Whenever there is a gathering with Europeans and Americans discussing about their relationship, there are some big numbers around, And here I have some of the big numbers. I took them from the excellent study by Bruce Stokes and Hugo Perman, the recent study on the transatlantic economy. But you can find similar numbers in many other studies. Numbers are necessarily big because our economies are big. And so we can congratulate mutually about how big or how important we are. It reminds me, however, a bit of the aristocratic European families, congratulating mutually about how big they are, how important they are, how strong is their relationship with the world around them changing. You can continue discussing and congratulating about those numbers. It does not change the fact that the world is changing. And so I think we have to take a measure of what's happening and question, how big really is the transatlantic economy, how integrated it is, and how relevant it is for the rest of the world, for the world at large. So, to start with how big, I've gone back to historical statistic that Angus Madison is providing to all of us about the size of economies over a very long period. And here you have the share of the transatlantic economy in the world GDP over 500 years. And what clearly you see here that the Industrial Revolution resulted in a major increase in both the relative size of Europe and, obviously, the emergence of the United States. And at some point, we culminated at 60% of world GDP in PPP terms, so corrected for price and exchange rate fluctuations. And that was back in the 70s, in the 60s. And since then, we have started seeing the relative size of the transatlantic economy declining to reach something like 40%, which is still obviously very big, but it's not anymore the situation we had when, for example, the G7 was created. If we go beyond this image and look at some projection for the future, I took the projection of Goldman Sachs. They are not exactly consistent in terms of price levels, so there is a break in the series. But that basically what they tell you. They tell you that by 2050, we should be roughly back to where we were pre-industrial revolution in terms of relative size in world GDP. You know, there are various assumptions behind such projection, but those assumptions are fairly natural. I mean, there is a lot that has to do with demographics. The rest is catching up, so you can be slightly more optimistic or slightly more pessimistic about the catching up of China, India, and the rest of the world. But basically, I don't think it would change things in a very major way. So the times clearly were our economies were representing 60% of world GDP are gone by far. We're going to go back probably in 50 years at something like 25% of world GDP, which is a completely different situation clearly in terms of relative strength and power. Now, second question is how integrated our economies. Here, look at the share of the transatlantic trade in world trade over a century. And as indicated by the blue bars, it has been consistently declining from some 16% of world trade to some 5% now. So clearly, it's much less important than it was, and it's difficult to say that it's an absolutely major element. If we exclude intra EU trade and intra North America trade, because I'm taking here North America and Europe as somewhat broader groupings than just the EU and the US. It's a bit higher, but still the decline is clear. So a shrinking share of world trade, perhaps more importantly, if we look at who is each region's main trade partner, we find that over time transatlantic link has become the less important one in this triangle between North America, Europe, and East Asia. I take here not China or Japan, but I take East Asia as a region, Europe as a region, and North America as a region. Those three regions, they represent today approximately the same proportion of world GDP, at least in purchasing power parity terms. So it's a good standard, and it's interesting to see that back in 1980, as indicated by the red numbers here, North America and Europe were each region's main trade partner. So they were reciprocally each other's main trade partner. Then Asia became more important for the U.S. And now Asia is more important for Europe too. So in pure trade terms, the weaker link now is the European North American link. And the main hub, I would say, is East Asia, reflecting obviously the rise of China in world trade. So that's, again, an indication that maybe the obvious character of the transatlantic link is not as strong as it often looks. Regionalism is also on the rise. Our two economies have been very busy building regional trade agreements away from the WTO or, at least to some degree away from the WTO multilateral system by creating regional trade agreements. And here you have a map on blue, basically, those are the European regional trade agreements, and in red or orange, the American ones. And you see that there is this network that is building, this is being built, and competing networks that, in fact, indicates, again, the fact that there are regional strategies in each case, and that's there's, with Mexico being part of both, actually. And that these regional strategies, again, indicate some distanciation from the standard approach. I would take from that the fact that, you know, the obvious character, the strength that is often emphasized of this transatlantic link is not as strong as it seems. But I would like to introduce two caveats. And two caveats are important, and I would like to emphasize where really this transatlantic dimension matters. Well, first, that if you take a number of indicators, you can find indicators that will tell you that the transatlantic economy is as small as 20% or 25% of world GDP of the world, and you can go as much as 90% if you take some other indicators. So I think we should look at those indicators. And second, the fact that there is significant integration on the financial side and on the investment side between the U.S. And Europe. So first, here, in terms of the degrees of smallness, if you go from the left to the right of the graph, you start with population, you continue with energy production, cereal consumption. So you find the U.S. Part or the North American part, sorry, in red, the European part in blue, and the rest of the world in red. And so you find some indicators for which, we collectively do not matter that much in the world. And then you go to the other extreme, and then you find bond markets, international debt markets, or foreign exchange reserves, and you find that overwhelmingly the U.S. And Europe are the two players. So it's striking that you have such a degree of variation, and it's striking that in all those fields you find both North America and Europe as being significant relative to each other. So I think that's where we should start from in terms of determining what is special in the role of U.S. and the U.S. And Europe in the world economy, where they've become just players and where they retain a specific role. The other dimension that I wanted to emphasize is the strength of the financial links. Unlike what's happening to trade, whenever you look at capital flows or capital stocks, I think capital stocks are more significant, you find that the degree of integration, this is tentative numbers, these are numbers for 2004 because it's difficult to build. I mean, those numbers are not readily available. It's difficult to build those numbers for more recent years. But basically what they tell you is that in the strength of those bilateral links has increased, and they very much dwarfed the links that exist with other regions of the world. So we have these links, and we have this relative strength. What I would take from that, and that would be my conclusion from this series of graphs, that there is a very uneven landscape, that we have fields where the EU and the US are merely players in the world economy alongside other players. And I would say that it's obviously the case for energy, for whatever has to do with climate, and we see that clearly in the discussion pre-Copenhagen, with food, but also in fields such as trade, and increasingly, I would say, macro, and I'm going to go back to that. And then there are fields where they retain a near monopolist role, and I would especially emphasize market regulation and currencies. And so I would like to just to discuss now what this implies. Moving thus to the discussion of the agenda, if you start from an observation of this sort, you would wish to say that, you know, there are different types of fields. There are fields where Europe and the U.S. are merely players, and there you would wonder whether there is anything special in their relationship, in their role, and you would venture that naturally they would basically interact as other players, as big players, but as other big players in a multilateral setting, depending on preferences and interests. And maybe keeping a founding father's role because of history, but not having any special role beyond that with respect to other players. And then you would go to the monopoly fields where their position, their role put them in the situation of being the providers of some global public goods, like the rules, setting the rule for the global economy, supplying global currencies. And then you would be led to suggesting that the approach there should be that there would be some form of co-responsibility in supplying those global public goods. In other words, not to abuse the monopoly power or the near monopoly power, but to use it engaging other players in order to influence the rules of the game. And so I would like to use this benchmark to assess the situation in a few fields and assess achievements. I will start with trade. The trade case is interesting because things have happened already. Up to 2003, to the Cancun conference of the WTO, there was this vision that the US and the EU were the two big players in the game. And so that essentially a trade deal was a deal between the US and the EU, and that all the rest would in the end, come to some form of consistency between, with the deal between the US and the EU. In 2003, there was suddenly the realization that this was no more the case, that simply a deal between the US and the EU was not a sufficient condition for a global deal anymore, that the topics that we on the transatlantic side wanted to put on the agenda were not accepted by our trade partners. And since then, the scene has completely changed. So we still have the US and the EU, but we have obviously the new players. We have India, we have China, we have Brazil, and the nature of the international negotiation have fundamentally changed. So, in fact, we are part of the multilateral framework. We have interests, we have sectoral interests, we have strategy, we have alliances. And in some cases, I would say in the best of cases, the fact that the US and the EU are pushing in the same direction helps find an agreement. But that's the best we can do. It's a kind of an ordinary economic relationship between two major players in a world that has become more complex. Interestingly, the same seems to be happening in the macro field. The macro field was the remit of the G7, and the G7 was the essentially transatlantic, with Japan as the part of it, but you know, the vast majority of countries being part were U.S. and Europe. And we were used to thinking that whatever is taking place in the G7, all the decisions, the discretionary impulses come from G7 countries. The rest of the world basically reacts to those impulses. And the G7 also serves as a steering group for giving some blessing or some suggestions to the Bretton Woods institutions in dealing with the situation in the rest of the world. That was very much the implicit model. And it has worked like that, including until the early years of this decade. So the G7 was not a very effective group internally in terms of coordinating policy, but it was a rather effective group externally in terms of precisely taking initiative and giving blessing or suggestion to the IMF on how to deal with crisis in the emerging world. The crisis has changed all that, and to an extent that is considerable. The macro response to the crisis was coordinated at G20 level. And in fact, the G20 non-G7 members have delivered a stronger stimulus than the G7 members. This graph is taken from the IMF estimates. So you have all the G20 countries, and the bar represents the size of the stimulus delivered in 2009 by the countries. So in response to this coordinated stimulus program in percent of GDP. And I've put in blue the European countries, in red the U.S., and in kind of a dark red, the non-U.S., non-European countries. What is striking is that there are many emerging countries that delivered more stimulus than Europe. And on average, according to IMF estimates, the G20 stimulus is at the same level as the U.S. stimulus, in spite of the fact that the European countries have delivered less. So, in fact, the stimulus by the rest of the world compensated the lack of stimulus on the European side. Now, the Europeans would say, because of the size of automatic stabilizers, they in fact delivered more, perhaps. I mean, that's a secondary discussion. What I think is absolutely striking is that, for the first time, we went much beyond the traditional approach of dealing with macro policy at G7 level, and that was not only in terms of words, it was in terms of actual decisions. So this has, I think, put us in a different world where not only the traditional players are macro players, but new players also. So it's a new conversation that is starting. And at the Pittsburgh Summit, there was a framework adopted for international coordination. And that's this framework essentially has the ambition of coordinating the next steps, the exits from the crisis, the rebalancing of world growth, addressing global imbalances, all that at G20 level. So the macro conversation has moved completely. And for good reasons, because we know that the imbalances discussion is not a discussion that can take place within the G7. It has to take place with countries not belonging to G7, first of all, China. But this transatlantic dimension has here disappeared. And what is interesting also is that the G20 framework actually requests countries, depending on the situation being in deficit or in surplus, to pledge to different policies. And the question comes, you know, whether it applies to the Europe as a whole or to European countries individually. So the G20 is actually trying to achieve what has not been achieved so far within the G7, which even that hasn't been achieved within the EU or the euro area. It's a very ambitious agenda that they're starting. That's again a completely new discussion. Okay, let me move now to fields where I think we're in a different situation, where Europe and the US are more monopolists, have a more initiative that is a determinant. In a book that we published 2 years ago, edited by my colleague André Sapir, we said the US and Europe are the regulators of the world, meaning that essentially the rules that they set are the rules for the world economy, for reasons that have to do with market size, not in PPP terms, but in current dollars terms. They still represent 60 to 65% of global demand and of sophistication. And interestingly, what we observe in many fields is that there is not a race to the bottom, but a race to the top. The more demanding the standards you set, if you're a big enough economy, since there is a fixed cost to satisfying your standards, think of car safety or whatever of this sort, you have to adapt to this standard. And when you have adapted, when a producer has adapted, there is limited cost to using the standards on other markets. So basically, if you're a big enough market, you can set a standard that then becomes a global standard. And that's true both for, technical standards, but it's true also for a number of standards. You know, you can think of a physical product or a financial product in roughly the same way. We have also, interestingly, the situation with competition policy, where if you're a big enough market, you can say, I want you to sell on my market, I want you to be competitive, so I want those companies that may have wished to merge not to merge. That happened with GE and Honeywell with the European decision under Commissioner Mario Monti. This happened again with some recent decision for Microsoft. So basically, if you have a big enough market, you have a lot of power that you can use. And here the situation is a situation where market regulation is really a domain where the US and Europe run the world. This leads, therefore, to think in different terms about the bilateral agenda. If we take the bilateral agenda as it has developed, there have been many attempts to integrate, to create some sort of free trade area between Europe and the US. We can go back to the 60s. We can go back to the many projects in the 90s. And again and again, this has been disappointing. The recent evolution, the one of 2007, was to put not so much the focus on the trade dimension, but on the regulatory dimension, on the regulatory dialogue, and on the fact that there was a room here for discussion on cooperation in setting the rule for the global economy. And in my view, it's a very positive move, because it has moved away from an area where there is not much to gain, to an area where there is clearly a joint responsibility of magnitude between Europe and the US. However, what we can observe is that there have been few achievements, and even few achievements from this recent initiative. So, as I said, the tech is meeting tomorrow, but the observation we have on what has been achieved, and here there are people who know much better than I do, but I just refer to what the progress report writes, that there hasn't been much in terms of actual deliverables, just ongoing discussions, making incremental progress, and not delivering any big result. So in spite of the willingness to focus on some lighthouse projects where there was the expectation that something would be delivered, I don't know exactly why. Perhaps too much emphasis on detail, and perhaps more a lack of ownership in this process that was initiated, but was not really supported politically by much ownership on the part of the two sides. Anyway, this discussion, in spite of, again, I mean, what could be hoped to be delivered in this field, has not yet delivered much. So pre-crisis, we had a relatively slow convergence of standards and rules between the two sides. We had some interesting experiments going on in different fields, including on the accounting side, where my colleague here, Nicolas Véron, has written on the global accounting experiments, which consisted in subcontracting to the private sector the definition of standards. That was the approach adopted by Europe, and there was some hope of convergence. There was the record was relatively mixed. Now, what has the crisis brought here is essentially that with the enlargement of the Financial Stability Forum into the Financial Stability Board, the emerging countries have been drafted into the group that is supposed to write the rule of global finance for the future. It's an interesting a very important experiment, because we have both a combination of a clear leadership of the US and the EU in this process, because certainly, whenever you have to decide on the reform of financial regulation, it's the countries where the system is the most sophisticated, it's the countries where the problems arose because of the sophistication of the system that have the most important role. So there's a combination of leadership and participation of other players, which is kind of the spirit of what I was mentioning as an open source approach, where you have the leadership, but also you include other players. Interestingly, we see emerging some notion that maybe the rules that are adequate may not be the same for everyone because of the different degrees of sophistication. And it was Andrew Sheng, the scholar of Hong Kong, said, do we want rules for Tatas or for Ferraris? We have to decide what kind of rule we want globally, because maybe we don't need exactly the same rules. And I think the fact that there is wider participation in the setting of rule is bound to bring this kind of discussion. So there, in a way, I would say that's a positive change that the difficult, certainly, but positive that the G20 has given to the widened FSB this role. At the same time, we're seeing some challenge to previous achievements, and especially we're seeing that on the accounting side, there may be some divergence after the movement towards convergence that we saw in the past. Let me move to my second topic, where we can also characterize the two players as monopolist, which is the domain of currencies. Well, it is well known that international currencies have natural monopoly character because of network effects, kind of the same as for language. The number of people who use your currency is a strong determinant of the attractiveness of this currency. And this is why, and we all know that, this is why we've had historically one international currency. Interestingly, sometimes there were more than one. The discussion that has started now, after especially the famous paper by Governor Zhou of the People's Bank of China in the spring, the discussion that has started now is a discussion about, whether we are going in the long run towards a multi-currency system, with the role of the euro as an international currency becoming possibly a stepping stone towards a system of this sort. So this is a discussion that is very much still at early stage, where people have restarted essentially a conversation that has disappeared entirely for many decades, since essentially the end of the Bretton Woods system, after the nostalgia had disappeared. Everybody was used to the situation and considered that the situation was stable. Now a new discussion has started. This discussion involves interesting controversies about, you know, what the view of the U.S. could be. In a book that I edited with Adam Posen of Peterson Institute a few weeks ago, there was a discussion between Fred and Larry Summers, where Fred was maintaining that the possible competition from another currency would be a healthy competition for the U.S., and Larry Summers was in clear disagreement, saying that he didn't see the point and the reason why there was a need for competition. I think that's a discussion, again, that is starting. But what is clear here, is that I think it's a wide consensus on that, is that whatever the range of changes possible in the medium term, the only possible alternative in the medium term is the euro, and is a wider role for the euro that would be then a step towards some more fundamental changes in the longer run. The state of play in this respect is that the U.S. dollar is the global currency, and it's very clear, and again I'm referring here to this book that I've edited recently, that the euro is a regional currency. It's a regional success. It's a clear success, but there is no indication of a wider role beyond the regional role. So you take across a range of indicators, from the exchange rate policies that are followed, from the reserve, from the trade invoicing, from financial instruments, you find always the same. That's basically around the euro area, there is a wider region where the euro is in use, but it does not go beyond at this stage. So the question is whether this incumbency advantage is just a reflection of the fact that there's so many advantages of using the currencies that exist, or whether it's because of some self-limitations on the side of the euro area. And I think that there are some of these self-limitations that exist. There is clearly the growth potential of the euro area that is a question. That questions about governance system, ability to behave in situation of crisis, and we saw that, for example, with the provision of swap agreements, the very different attitude of the Federal Reserve and the ECB, the degree of financial integration that underpins the currency, the existence of an integrated bond market, and the attitude in general towards internationalization of the currency. So here there are a number of questions about what is the attitude in Europe. The crisis has highlighted the role of the dollar. At the same time, it has led, interestingly, to question about, you know, what is this role going to be in the medium term. And this graph represents a network of swap agreements that were introduced in the fall of last year, very clearly with a central role for the swap agreements provided by the Federal Reserve as a corresponding to both, in fact, the role of the dollar and the attitude of the Federal Reserve in providing dollar liquidity to other central banks and the reluctance of the ECB to do the same. Okay, what is the conclusion from all that? I think we all have to remember that Dean Acheson was used to say that, the gestation period for monetary arrangements is very long, twice as long as for elephants, referring to the Bretton Woods Agreement. And so whatever is going to change is going to change over the medium term. What I would consider useful is a serious discussion on those issues between the US and the EU, and a discussion that would, you know, not be exclusively about short-term exchange rate developments and their implication and the frictions they may lead to, but about also some more longer-term implication. These discussions would ideally also involve some other players, and you know, there is a need, in my view, to a discussion of this sort to develop, because again, if the we consider that stability in the long run imply that there is some correspondence between relative economic weights and the structure of international monetary arrangements, then it justifies having such such discussion. So summing up and getting closer to conclusion because I'm running late, what I would like to emphasize is that, again, we have at the same time this kind of move to a very ordinary relationship in fields like trade and, I was saying, macro, and there's a scope for special relationship on regulation and currencies. So the question is, you know, what, and this brings to the conclusion, what are the conclusions, what are the conditions for some effectiveness in this respect? And especially, I would say, the discussion is a discussion about Europe. At least this is certainly the field where I feel more competent, about whether Europe is ready for having a discussion of this sort, and whether Europe is able to that. Well, Europe, in terms of overall attitude, is certainly has moved very much in the direction of emphasizing its ability to shape the environment, to shape the global economy as one of the key role it wants to have. And this is taken from a declaration of the European Council, the Declaration of on Globalization, where the European Council, after a discussion that had started on, you know, whether globalization represents a challenge to Europe, concluded that the EU was, in fact, in a position to influence globalization, to shape globalization. So rhetorically, I think this kind of approach that I was suggesting is very much in line with the way Europe has indicated it wants to go. Now, there's a question of ability to deliver, of effectiveness. And in this respect, generally, the difficulties that the EU has in external economic relations essentially reflect this difficulty there is at home in determining who is responsible for that. So internal governance very much determines the effectiveness externally. And here, in a way, I mean, the two fields I've emphasized, market regulation and currencies, they're clearly responsibilities of the EU, not of national governments. I mean, there is some scope for discussion on market regulation, but essentially the single market brings this responsibility for the EU, and for the currency, it's obvious. So there is less of a risk of a kind of fragmented power syndrome in this field than there are in some other fields, like, for example, macro policy, where the responsibility is, by definition, shared. However, there are questions on the European side on on both dimensions. On the regulatory side, there's a question on the ability of the EU to take initiatives and to put forward an agenda. It is striking that after the crisis, Europe has put forward a rather limited agenda, and in fact, it has focused on sorting out the problems with responsibilities for supervision and the role of macro supervision that was in fact assigned initially to countries and has to be scaled up to the European level. So that's essentially what Europe has done in effect after the crisis. It hasn't put forward a major agenda for reforming financial regulation at global level. And there's a question of even whether the G20 taking the leadership with the US, having a much wider agenda for reform here, whether the G20 is in some respect going to, in fact, substitute the European level for a number of initiatives. So I would say there's a question here that is not that has, doesn't have to do with legal powers, but more with the ability to use these legal powers and with the initiative. On currencies, it's a bit the same in a way because clearly responsibility is an EU responsibility and is an ECB responsibility, but the questions that are raised go much beyond the responsibilities of the ECB. The question that the conditions for the EU to take a wider role have less to do with monetary policies and with the underlying dimension of financial integration, of macro policies, of crisis management. So questions that involve governments also. So I would say that on those two fields, there are questions about, you know, Europe's ability to engage in discussion of the sort I was advocating. And I think I should stop here with just saying that, again, this discussion is more perhaps a European than the US obsession, and that whatever happens, we will continue being important players. But the degree to which the crisis has changed a certain number of dimensions of this discussion is striking. And I think there are deep questions for Europe as regards its ability to engage in a fruitful discussion on this basis in the years to come. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure to walk across the street and participate in this session here at Brookings. I'm not sure if Brookings and the Peterson Institute are the G2 of American think tanks, but we can at least argue the case in our parochial views here in this part of Mass Avenue. Fiona introduced me with this comment that somebody had referred to me as one of the 10 people who can change your lives. That was a little survey USA Today did a couple of years ago, but she only gave half the quote. The full quote was, "These are 10 people who can change your lives that you never heard of." So the full quote puts it a little more in perspective. It's a particular pleasure to have an opportunity to comment on the remarks of my good friend Jean Pisani-Ferry. We've been joint authors together. We've been colleagues for many, many years. And whatever the situation here in Washington in terms of think tanks, his central role in creating and managing Bruegel has added a very major dimension to the global think tank network, and really in a very short period of time has become the leading voice in Europe on a whole range of issues, particularly, and that was its focus starting up, Europe's role in the world economy. Too much of the previous European thinking had been inward focused. That may be part of the problem that we talk about here in terms of Europe's global role. But certainly Bruegel has made a massive effort to correct that lacuna from the past. And I want to congratulate Joan on the enormously successful initiative that he and his colleagues have achieved just literally in a period of fewer than 5 years. I'd like to do three things in my brief remarks. One is to talk about the transatlantic leadership role, the G's and all that. Second, just a few small analytical comments because I agree with most of what Joan said, but I have a couple of points that, like any good commentator, I have to put on the table to dissent. And then thirdly, really dwell a little bit on the issue that he quite rightly focused on at the end, where the U.S. and EU have a collective responsibility for global leadership, namely in the currency and international monetary area. On the G's and all that, Jones started out by suggesting that I may not have been totally consistent. He gave you some quotes where I had different G2s in mind. But let me suggest that I have been totally consistent in the following sense. Throughout my career, which goes back now too many decades to recount, I have always been looking for partners for the United States to co-lead the world economy. Because even going back a long way, I felt that the U.S. could not and should not do it alone and needed partners. Indeed, if Joan had added to the list of quotes, he would have gone back to the mid-1970s, when I was promoting what I then called bigemony between the United States and Germany. Helmut Schmidt gave me massive grief for even suggesting that a country the size of Oregon, which was the Federal Republic, West Germany, had any business in the same league as the United States, despite the DM being the world's second key currency for the entirety of the post-war period pre-Euro. So that has been my theme, but the implementation of that theme has led to the progression of suggestions for partners that Joan pointed out. Indeed, I would suggest that Europe missed its moment. In a certain historical period, certainly through the 90s and even into the early part of this decade, Europe, and particularly Euroland as it came into the picture, was unquestionably the other and only other economic superpower. And so there was a period when Europe could have partnered with the United States to be a joint leader of the world economy, and indeed in a couple of areas where Europe as a group had joint competence, like trade, there was for a while a functioning G2. But Europe failed to develop joint responsibility, joint positions, joint representation in very many other areas, and therefore, I think, missed its moment in a big way. That's not historically unique. Japan, as it became feared as the dominant global economic competitor, back in the 70s already, into the 80s and into the early 90s, also missed its moment to become a true global economic leader. And its last 20 years, of course, have disqualified it from that status. What has happened in the meanwhile is that we now have witnessed the emergence of a third global economic superpower, along with the U.S. and EU, and that's, of course, China. But China, despite having some internal politics as well, albeit of a different sort than we do, does speak with a single voice on most issues, can indeed cooperate with the United States, which more or less speaks with a single voice, and therefore is the candidate now to provide that joint leadership of the world economy. I could go into that in great detail. I won't do so further. But I do think that the facts on the ground suggest we have moved very far toward a U.S.-China G2. Quite properly, neither country will ever use the term. Both will deny that it exists. Neither would want to rub other countries' noses in the fact that it is en route. But anybody who participated in the strategic and economic dialogue here 3 months ago observes the way the two countries have moved together on a whole variety of issues, including now climate change, I think would find it hard to deny that that's the closest thing we've got to a kind of global economic caucus within the G20, the steering committee for the steering committee, which is needed because the 20 is too large. That's obviously not to say that Europe is unimportant. Europe is a necessary participant in virtually all international agreements that will have meaning. But when you think about where the real action is and where the most important agreements are to be found as necessary, if not sufficient, conditions for global agreement, it's between the United States and China. And I think we are moving very far in that direction. Europe, in a way, helped set that up by missing the moment when, had it gotten its act together as a global actor, it could have clearly established a functioning G2 with the United States that would have, of course, had to accommodate China and others as time passes, but would have set in place an organizational structure that certainly would have persisted for quite some period of time. Second, a few analytical points. Joan mentioned in his recitation of facts a few key elements where the U.S. and Europe together were or were not critical to the global picture. I would add one. As some of you know, at our Peterson Institute, my colleagues, Gary Huffbauer and several colleagues, came up with a calculation a few years ago that tried to estimate the net impact on the U.S. economy of globalization. In fact, it was Larry Summers who suggested that we try to come up with a single figure to capture the impact of globalization on the U.S. economy. And so, with a few heroic assumptions and methodological creativity, we came up with the suggestion that the U.S. economy was $1 trillion per year richer as a result of the globalization of the last 50 years. If anything, incidentally, a conservative estimate. But we built it up with four different models, different perspectives, and nice round number, $1 trillion per year. In a subsequent exercise, we then tried to disaggregate that regionally and came up with the conclusion that about 300 billion of the trillion, fully 30% of the total, was due to the U.S. economic relationship with Europe. And that was far greater than any other piece of the $1 trillion. Note that's a much greater share than the U.S.-Europe trade share. The reason is what Joan stressed, the financial side of it, particularly the huge two-way direct investment flow between the U.S. and Europe, which we weighted pretty heavily in that calculation, and concluded that 30% of the globalization gains to the U.S. came from the relationship with Europe. I suspect that somewhat similar ratios would apply if it were done from the European side, and I would suggest that Bruegel make similar calculations as it goes forward with its work program in Brussels. A second analytical point, where I frankly think Joan made a big error, was in his chart on slide 14, where he was showing the share of the transatlantic economy in the world. And if you recall, on the far right-hand side of that slide was a bar for foreign exchange reserves, in which he showed, I think if I read it right, that North America and Europe accounted for the overwhelming share of the total. But that can't be right, because we know that China alone has 10 times, what's that, 4X reserves.
Currency composition.
Oh, you mean liabilities.
Yes.
Okay. Point corrected. Obviously, in terms of reserves, you know well, that would not be the case.
It would be at the other end.
Exactly, at the other end. Just wanted to clarify that for the audience. Third analytical question, which I won't elaborate, but bears elaboration, and particularly at Bruegel with his work program on Europe and the world. Joan mentioned, but did not dwell, on one big component of the current G20 and global macro debate, namely the rebalancing issue. The need not only to achieve concerted recovery from the global recession, but to do so in a way that does not replicate the big imbalances of the past, which, at least on my view, Ben Bernanke's view, were a major source of the crisis itself by creating monetary conditions that were conducive to underpricing of risk, over-leveraging, and all the things that brought on the crisis. The European aspect, as Joan hinted but didn't elaborate, was that there are huge imbalances within Europe, the same way there are between the United States and China. Indeed, the Germany-Spain imbalance is not so different from the U.S.-China imbalance as shares of the economies of both. Yet the intra-European imbalances have escaped most international attention. Joan poses a question, is it an intra-European question or is it an external question? The Europeans, of course, try to have it both ways. The Germans in particular say, well, don't come to us about our surpluses because we don't even have a currency. We're behind the euro and that's everybody, and so how could we do anything about it even if there were a problem? But the fact that Germany is the world's still largest current account surplus country should not escape attention in the international debate as to where to go with the international adjustment process to avoid replication of the kind of problems that caused the crisis, yes, in Spain and Ireland and others within Europe, as well as between the United States and China. So just one more dimension for the research agenda at our partner institute in Brussels. Joan asked, in ticking off the U.S.-Europe agenda, why have the results been so few and far between? And why, as I suggest, did Europe miss its moment? Well, a lot of the efforts were on the trade side, as he said. There you ran into two problems. One was that barriers weren't very high already because both sides had brought them down. And much to the credit of Europe, incidentally, recall the history of the transatlantic relationship. Every time Europe did take a step forward, Treaty of Rome, creation of the EU itself, the expansion to the UK, the subsequent expansion to others, each time the U.S., disliking the new discrimination against its trade that was generated, called for a multilateral initiative to reduce barriers at the global level. And to their great credit, though sometimes kicking and screaming, the Europeans agreed to do it. And that's a very important historical pattern because the same thing may now happen with Asia. Because as Asia creates a bloc, as it's clearly in the process of doing, it will discriminate against both Europe and the United States. Hopefully, Europe and the United States will together insist that the new Asian bloc negotiate multilaterally to reduce its new barriers, its new discrimination against us. And hopefully, the Asians will take that part of the European experience seriously and comply and agree to do it. But, of course, that means the U.S. and Europe have to get together and pursue it themselves and be willing to do, as the U.S. was back in the previous generation, put its own barriers on the table and make a negotiation politically possible. So that, I think, is part of what happened in the Europe-U.S. case, because the barriers at the border had been largely reduced, the effort, transatlantic dialogue, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, was to go behind the border to regulatory and other changes. Those turned out to be politically very difficult, not very sexy politically, and the whole thing foundered, although I would suggest a more responsive European approach would have helped solidify that G2 of the type I talked about before. Finally, there is one big area, Joan was exactly right, where we have a duopoly, where the U.S. and Europe are, Euroland to be more precise, are the only game in town. The renminbi as an international currency is far down the road. Japan clearly missed its moment. The yen is nowhere. And so it really is the euro and the dollar, with the dollar still the senior partner, but clearly a movement in other directions. I would demur a little bit from Joan when he says, and did in a recent article with my former deputy director, Adam Posen, that the euro is only a regional currency. I think that's a little excessively modest. Countries from China to Australia and a few others around the world clearly are diversifying their reserves at least modestly into euro. When you move out of the dollar, you do move into euro. That is the alternative. Joan's exactly right. And so a number of countries around the world are doing it at least modestly. It's in the eye of the beholder, whether it's big or small, but it certainly is happening. And as diversification continues, the euro's role will play an increasing position. The other analytical point I would make is that when Joan describes the reasons why the euro has not become a more global currency, I would emphasize one that he did not cite, which is the absence of fiscal consolidation of the EU or even Euroland. And not so much for macro reasons, but because only if there is a fiscal dimension to European integration will Europe ever develop a Euro-wide capital market that could compete with the U.S. capital market. In short, they need a Euro bill to compete with the T-bill if the Euro is really to compete with the dollar. Because the overwhelming advantage the U.S. still has, particularly for the dollar as a reserve asset, given the liquidity preferences of central banks around the world, the overwhelming advantage of the dollar and the United States still, despite that the two economic areas are the same in size, is the financial market in the U.S. with a T-bill, which, as the crisis showed when everybody ran into it, despite the U.S. being the epicenter of the crisis, the T-bill was the asset of choice. And even well before the crisis, and now well after the crisis, we hope, the T-bill is still the instrument of choice for foreign central banks and others with very high liquidity preference. And so until the Europeans come up with a competitive financial instrument, call it a euro bill, I don't think they will have quite the capability to compete with the dollar fully at the global level. Now, the Europeans have not sought a global key currency role. They certainly are not attempting to compete with the dollar. But I think the system is moving in that direction, I would say desirably so. If that's the case, final point, what does that mean for U.S.-Europe cooperation? Well, Joan said we should have a discussion, and is my want, I'll try to push that discussion a little forward by putting a couple of specific ideas on the table. If it's true that the U.S. and EU, or at least Euroland, are the joint custodians of the world's two global currencies, then I would submit there is a systemic responsibility. What is it? For global financial stability. Currencies are the lifeblood of the world economy, same way a national currency is lifeblood of your domestic economy, and so there's a responsibility to manage that in a constructive and stable and supportive way of global economic activity. However, if you look at the record of the U.S.-Euro or the dollar-euro relationship over its first decade of coexistence, the record is anything but stable. 9 years ago, the euro was worth 80 cents to the dollar. Now it's worth $1.60. Not exactly a stable financial relationship. There have been periods of prolonged misalignment between the two currencies. I think now, frankly, they're right about at an equilibrium level, as we at least would define it. But there have been periods of prolonged misalignment, and there certainly have been periods of huge fluctuation. Indeed, in some sense, when countries like China, Russia, others complain about the volatility of the dollar, what they're really complaining about is the volatility of the dollar-euro rate, since the euro is the other currency into which they might move, and since it takes two to tango for any exchange rate to be flexible, volatile, or stable. So if there's a collective responsibility, then it would seem to me that the two custodians, Euroland and the U.S., have a responsibility to support more international financial stability. In addition, there's the specific issue, if you believe that there is a long-term secular diversification process going on now from dollar to euro, inevitably will occur over time, particularly as Europeans move toward creating a euro bill, then you have a worry about a kind of secular downward push on the dollar, upward push on the euro that may not be desirable to either. Depending on how that happened by diversifying countries, think Russia, think Argentina, think Australia, think many countries with large reserves in various periods of time who may not have systemic stability at the center of their concerns, then there's, I think, a U.S.-European responsibility to manage that process in an orderly way. So there are two possibilities. On the second one, the diversification, the straightforward thing to do is to put in place a substitution account at the International Monetary Fund where countries who want to diversify, dollars to euros or anything else, but it would mainly be dollars to euros, can do so off market. The problem, of course, is that if China decides to diversify a third of its $2.5 trillion into euros, there will be big, big effects on the markets. Dollar goes down, euro goes up, neither countries like it, and in fact the effect is probably hugely magnified by the psychological effects of a big reserve holder like that moving out of one asset into another. The straightforward way to circumvent that problem, doesn't solve all the issues, but comes pretty close, would be to create a substitution account in the IMF so that a country wanting to diversify could do so off market, put its dollars into the IMF, get special drawing rights in return that achieves diversification very clearly and ipso facto, not as much as moving wholly into euros, but with the trade-off benefit of minimizing systemic instability. Such an account was actually negotiated for a period of a year and a half back in the late 70s when we had the previous period of movement out of the dollar. The negotiations came very close to reaching agreement, failed to do so for some technical reasons, and then the dollar started to strengthen, and so the countries diversifying forgot about it. But it could easily be brought back. And if we thought there was going to be a secular move out of dollars into euros, that would be a straightforward way to minimize the instability risk that would result. The U.S. and Europe could get together, do some things bilaterally, but I think the IMF route is more readily available. On the broader point of avoiding huge volatility between euro and dollar, and more importantly, in my view, avoiding prolonged misalignments, the straightforward way would be to dust off another idea, which, as Jones said, for some others, has been dormant for a couple of decades, and that's the idea of target zones for the currencies. Broad bands, plus or minus 10, even 15%, that would make no effort to pinpoint the relationship between the currencies, but would put wide bands around them so as to limit the huge overshoots in both directions, which we have seen in the dollar-euro market over time. And so if the two authorities were serious about exercising their collective responsibility for reducing instability in the global monetary system, that would be a well-thought-out, well-researched, well-understood way to go. It's controversial. I don't suggest that there's anything like unanimity to go that way. Indeed, both the official and the academic consensus at this point is on the other side. But it would be, in my view, a very positive and constructive way to go. It would be a way for the EU, and Euroland in particular, to reclaim a G2 role, at least on the monetary side, in an area where it still does have duopoly power, and therefore the implications would be broad as well as narrow. Thanks very much.
Well, we didn't keep to our promise of being relatively prompt, but we've been talking in a nice triangular fashion about the EU, the US, and China. So in the spirit of threes rather than twos, and given the time, I'm going to take three questions from the floor, and then I'll allow our G2 to respond to them. So I'll try to take one from the back, one from the middle, and one from the front, if there is anyone. Okay. Gentleman right at the back, I think Ira Strauss.
Hi.
Someone in the middle over here, and then a gentleman at the front, and I'm sorry for others.
A quick question about your categories. Your conclusions followed marvelously from your categories, but you gave three different, probably unintentionally, but three different definitions of transatlantic, and they are contradictory to each other. One is the U.S. and EU, but the EU and its precursor EC didn't exist before 1950. Surely there was a transatlantic economy before that. The second definition on your chart of the rise and fall of transatlantic economic power, you had four or five groups of countries, among them Eastern Europe, Western Europe, America, Canada. But Eastern Europe has not been a part of the transatlantic economy except since 1991. Not all of Western Europe was before 1945. Some very big chunks certainly were not. So that would lead to the third definition, which is that the transatlantic is not a fixed group of countries, but a growing group, and the only definition you gave, which you discarded, half recognized that was the G7, an institution of the transatlantic grouping, which recognizes Japan as a part of it, and the existing transatlantic grouping. If one looked at the existing transatlantic groupings in history, one would not find a rise and decline. One would find a rise and a stabilization. OECD today is 73% of the world economy. There's no decline there compared to OECD in 1965. Or OEEC in 1955, or the actual transatlantic group in 1935. One would see horizontal growth of the transatlantic grouping as more countries become first world democracies, vertical growth of other countries as they catch up economically. That's a very stable world situation. That implies a lot of the current dialogue is unfounded.
Okay, now can we take a question here in the middle and then at the front? And then, actually, I just see one gentleman over here. We'll just take these questions, we'll make it four, and then go to our panel.
Thank you. Pontus Brownian, Professor in Economics, Royal Institute of Technology, Stockholm. Mr. Pisani-Ferry, you argued that there is still some monopoly power for the EU and the US to exercise when it comes to regulating the world economy. And also shaping the future of the world, so to speak. And I think Mr. Bergstein agreed to that. I like to challenge that a little bit. In the short term, yes, probably. In the medium term, perhaps. In the longer term, less likely, I would say. Then Mr. Bergstein also hinted at that there is still some power that can be exercised from the Chinese sides, which could shake up currencies, have an impact on interest rates, trade situations, etc. If you believe in the saving glut hypothesis, that could then incur major shifts in the economy, etc., etc. So how is that? And shouldn't we bring the third party on board from the start then? Thank you.
Very good, thanks. And then there's a gentleman here with a blue tie, and then one person over here.
Hi, Tyson Barker with the Bertelsmann Foundation. You guys had some discussion of the success, at least perceived success, of the U.S.-China strategic and economic dialogue, and that is sometimes used as code for a G2. On this, the eve of the Transatlantic Economic Council, I think it's safe to say that there is no talk of the tech being a G2 of any sort. My question would be, given the fact that regulatory issues in particular and accounting standards, IPR protection, all these issues that you mentioned in which the US-EU relationship still holds a monopoly hold on standard setting globally, what can we judge as being a success from tomorrow's meeting other than the fact that it takes place?
Okay, and sir, right at the back here. That's the gentleman here, yeah.
Thanks very much. I'm Sean Mulvaney. I'm the Director of Economic Policy at the German Marshall Fund. I really like your open source analogy, which gives the opportunity for the U.S. and EU to kind of model the way, but in an inclusive way. And my question relates to how you see, if the Lisbon Treaty is ratified, which we think it will be, how will that impact the ability of the EU's ability to create coherence in external relations on economic policy, so that maybe some of the things that both you and Fred talked about can come into a reality where there's a Brussels effort to help the collective action of working other EU capitals into a better posture.
Thanks very much. And apologies to everybody else who wanted a question there, but we have four actually extremely wide-ranging questions on the transatlantic definitions. The long-term impact of China on US and EU monopoly power, whether the tech will achieve anything tomorrow or not. Let's hope nobody's sitting here who's going to the meeting tomorrow to listen to this. And then the impact of the Lisbon Treaty. So perhaps, Jean, if you'd like to start, and then we'll let
Okay, thank you. Well, I fully recognize that my definitions are not entirely the same throughout the presentation I've made. I mean, I was relying on data, and so there's some data limitation. But basically, I don't think any sensible definition would make a major difference. What was proposed by the gentleman who's left, actually, was that we would take a definition, an institutional definition, and that broadening the group. The group would become large enough for it to be stable, a stable share in the world. Certainly, I mean, but OECD now includes Mexico. The OECD is trying to include other countries. So I don't think that it's relevant to with respect to what I was trying to do. I was simply trying to to present a simple fact that, you know, this transatlantic economy has grown as a proportion of world GDP enormously, and then this process has come to an end and has been reversed. I think any sensible definition would give the same. On the monopoly of shaping the rule, and that relates to the question about the open source, yes, I agree there is no monopoly in the long term. It's an absolutely temporary monopoly or duopoly. That relates to the fact that our markets at this stage have a size and a sophistication that gives our economies responsibility in defining those rules, and that nobody can really challenge that. The challenge is very near. If you take, for example, the standards for mobile telephony, 10 years ago it was obvious that those standards were defined in Europe and the U.S. Now the next step might be that they're going to be defined where the market grows, which is likely to be China and Asia in general. So things are moving extremely fast, but there is a window. In the window where when our economies are still in a position to have a very strong influence in the definition of the rule. And then there's a question of strategy. And the question is, you know, how you use this power, how inclusive you are. I mean, that's the open source analogy, that you basically use your influence to shape the rules, but at the same time you adopt a strategy that gives ownership to other participants in the rules that you're creating, in order for them to consider tomorrow that they have their ownership, they are their rules, they are able to reform them, they are able to change them in some direction, but they don't need to destroy them just because they've become more powerful. So I think that's really for the next 20 years that's major strategic choice for us. In 20 years, certainly the power of the U.S. and the EU in determining those rules would have greatly diminished. So in this respect, I very much take the point that Europe has missed its moment, that as Fred was saying, but I think the moment is not totally over. In this respect, it's still there. And so that's what I would consider a major success. When you say what would be the success of tech, I'm not going to talk about the meeting tomorrow, but basically the strategic challenge is to be able to ensure a sufficient degree of convergence and a sufficient degree of inclusiveness in order to shape the rule for the future. Now, will Lisbon help? Yes, Lisbon will help, if only because not having ratified and put into force the treaty would have major political consequences. At the same time, what we're speaking of or not fields where Lisbon will make a major difference. I mean, we're speaking of single market, single currency fields. They're already there, and we can't expect anything major to happen as a consequence of the ratification.
The hour is late, and I will therefore comment only on the one question that Joan skipped over, and I'll do so by polling the group. This is a group of about 100 close observers of U.S.-Europe relations, self-selected. How many of you were aware that the tech is meeting tomorrow? That's more than I would have thought, maybe 10% of the group. That's more than I would have thought. Case closed. Not much G2 across the Atlantic anymore.
Well, I think we had a very impressive G2 here. Hopefully now, Fred, much more people, if they didn't know you already, will know that you can change their lives. And Jean, we'd like to thank you very much for flying all the way from Brussels to give this lecture in the middle of what's a very hectic time for you, given the global economic crisis. And we look forward to seeing more of the fruits of the collaboration between the two of you, and hope that we'll be able to welcome both of you back to Brookings. Fred, it's much easier because you're across the road, but back to Brookings again. And thank you to everyone else for coming to the 6th annual Raymond Aron Lecture. And again, our great thanks to our French colleagues for making this possible. I hope you all have a great evening.